Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program is brought to you by Firesider, a health tonic based on the traditional New England cure-all of raw apple cider vinegar and honey. For more information, visit firesider.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. It's a gorgeous sunny day here in Brooklyn, and we're here at Roberta's Pizza as usual, but we're joined by a great guest. His name is Derek Dellinger. He is the author of the new book, The Fermented Man, A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. Derek, we usually start the program talking about some news in food of the last week or so. This doesn't have to do with fermented foods, but hopefully you can, share some insight on this. So soda's been in the news a bit recently. Philadelphia passed the first soda tax, and it's actually pretty controversial. So a lot of folks are hailing this as a victory for public health. Basically, it's like they're treating soda like cigarettes, you know, it's like a danger. It's still legal, but if you want it, you have to pay a little extra for it. And then others are saying, even Bernie Sanders chimed in on this and said that it disproportionately affects folks who are poor who otherwise would like to have soda. And now it's a little bit more expensive. Of course, the soda companies are furious. Their sales have seen decline steadily for the last 10 years. As other drinks and beverages, presumably most of them are more healthy than soda, have taken a lot of market share. What are your thoughts on that, Derek? And also, you know, the big question is, okay, so Philly passed this. What about other cities now? Is it going to be a domino effect?
It's certainly not the first time it's come up. For sure. And like you said, their sales, I think, are already hurting, and I imagine they're going to continue to see a decline in sales, mm-hmm. regardless of the taxes. So, you know, I wonder if, you know, the tax almost over time becomes irrelevant one way or the other, just as competing options and awareness of the health ramifications of soda mm-hmm. increase. And, I mean, there's probably going to be the pushback against the taxes, but the same effect might be achieved even if they, you know, don't end up inspiring a domino effect with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big, strong statement to say that this right. soda is bad for you. You know, you're a healthy food advocate, so I feel like a lot of people are a little bit torn, though, because of the way that this may affect people of lower income.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I can't really say that I am necessarily in favor of, you know, just immediately taxing everything.
Exactly. Like, what if we tax candy?
Right. I mean, you can, I hate to go to the slippery slope fallacy thing, but like, you can very easily see how there's a slippery slope concern there. So I think it's beneficial just from the kind of like gimmicky standpoint of making it clear that, you know, the government sees this is not clearly not good for you. Mm-hmm. And maybe hopefully not have to actually get that carried away with taxing soda across the board and just finding ways to more raise that awareness without actually, you know, penalizing people who maybe just want to have a a soda every now and then and can't really afford it. But
even like the fancy sodas. And I think one thing that's interesting, and this really parallels the craft beer movement, and you're a brewer.
Right.
So you've seen this. This has been happening for like, what, 10 years now? Large beer companies are buying up smaller craft brands because they keep eating away at their market share. So Coca-Cola and Pepsi's response has been to launch their own craft soda lines. I was particularly amused. I'm reading an article in Mother Jones by Tom Philpott. He's talking about the new PepsiCo craft line called Stubborn Sodas. I don't get that. But
inexplicable name.
Its flavors including black cherry with tarragon, orange hibiscus, pineapple cream, and agave vanilla cream. And it'll have cane sugar instead of high fructose sweet corn syrup. This sounds to me like even like the flavors, it sounds kind of like Brooklyn Soda Works and other sort of craft brands we've seen around New York City. So it is interesting how that's really paralleling, can I say that? The craft beer movement.
I think that's a great observation because you see the same thing of the large companies trying to compete with the innovative smaller companies sort of put out these kind of crude facsimiles of what the smaller, innovative, healthier, better made companies are making. And all it really did in the case of the beer world is just kind of draw attention to the fact that there were better options out there, and everyone sees through the big companies kind of, sad attempts to.
Do they know that like?
Not everyone certainly. It's not like big companies aren't making money, but a lot of these kind of very obvious. The beer world has seen a lot of like failed attempts by the bigger breweries to Shock Top certainly doesn't do as well as Blue Moon, and like then there's a million imitators beyond that, and they don't always do well, and I think they just help draw attention to what they're trying to compete against when this giant lumbering company is all of a sudden putting out products that are completely, very clearly meant to compete with something else.
Yes.
The consumer all of a sudden is aware that there's something they're trying to compete against.
There's something wrong here.
Yeah, so.
In their world. What about them snapping up the smaller breweries? So, that a brewery in a tough place.
Right.
Would easily.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, there's endless debate about that in the beer world. Both sides get very, very passionate, and it keeps happening. So the debate seems to be never ending. And it's really tough to have an unbiased view on it, because in every individual case, you can kind of understand the position of the small brewer being bought. It's a really tough industry. It's a really tough job. It can really, really start to wear on you after a while. And maybe you just want to enjoy the rest of your life. And you worked hard for 10 years to start a company, and a couple million dollars, I'm sure, looks really good. And I can't entirely fault any one individual for wanting to maybe just like change their life a bit and have some money. At the same time, I don't think it's a good thing, in the broader scheme of things. I certainly don't think it's a good trend to have it continue happening, because it's exactly what happened 150 years ago, or not even that long ago, 60 years ago. And if it keeps consolidating, that's not good for anyone.
That's really a good point. Well, you are a brewer, and you decided to change your life in a very different way.
Yeah.
I guess strange way. And not for money. I don't know.
Not so much money in the publishing world.
Yeah. We know. But, okay, so, Derek, what inspired you to go for 1 year eating only fermented foods? And now I know that, fermenting is super huge right now, and it's a very big positive trend, I think, in eating and drinking as well.
Right.
But you went strictly fermented everything.
For the year of 2014.
With the exception of water.
With the exception of water, yeah. Had to stay hydrated.
And you're alive. Like,
I'm alive.
You don't seem like a crazy person, but
crazy or hopefully severely malnourished. No, I mean, it was the book is actually very meta about it being a very clearly, kind of over the top diet. And and a lot of what inspired me or interested me in going through with the project was how I could use it to explore American's fascination with extreme diets. Right, Americans in particular seem to have just an utter fascination with, you know, really strict or you know, diets that exclude one thing as like this miracle.
Juice cleanse.
Right. Like all they have to, like, you want to find that one thing that you can eliminate from your diet and it's just going to fix everything for you. We seem to have this, you know, just fascination with how eating works, how diets work. And obviously it's very difficult to come up with, across the board healthy diet for everyone, because health is something with so many variables. It's not the same for any one person. Right. So there never is going to be like one miracle cure all diet. It's a complicated issue.
So you're not advocating that everyone should, this is not like a diet book saying everyone should eat diet or fermented foods only, but this is sort of like a comment on perhaps the momentum around the fad of fermented.
Yeah. So where the idea came from, I was a brewer and a writer both, beforehand, had been looking for, I wrote a home brewing fermentation blog for a number of years, and I was just kind of thinking of ways to convey the ubiquity of fermentation to the general public. And I had this idea because I was getting more into fermented foods after having been a home brewer, beer and cider and kombucha for a number of years. It just kind of occurred to me one day, like shopping, that the same species of bacteria, lactobacillus, is found in pretty much, most fermented foods, which in turn encompass a much greater range of food in general than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
That fermentation is this hugely powerful and important and ubiquitous thing that's been in, you know, traditional foods and foods that we take for granted for thousands of years. And it just covers so much range. And most people don't have any inkling of this. Most people, when I would explain the diet to them, just could not understand what I possibly would be eating.
Right.
And that was kind of the hook for me, the idea that, one, that there's so much fermented food out there that you could actually live off of it.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at the folks eating pizza right now, and the bread, it's yeast,
bread,
you know,
is
fermented.
Fermented, yeah.
I didn't know, but the cheese also.
Cheese, mozzarella is a kind of dicey one where, like, you can make it a fermented way, and you can make it with just an enzymatic reaction that it's made very quickly, and there's no fermentation involved. So mozzarella is, like, a bad cheese example.
Okay.
But you can easily make pizza, obviously, with cheese that is fermented, which is pretty much almost any other cheese. The vast majority of cheese is fermented.
Right.
Obviously, if something is aged for weeks or months or years, fermentation is almost always involved. So I had this realization that, okay, fermentation is incredibly ubiquitous, and wow, I could actually probably live off of fermented foods. And that was just like a crazy thought experiment I had. Literally, at first, I was like, oh, I should tweet that. Just like that, it just popped in my head. That was just a thought, and it kind of snowballed from there. I talked to, again, kind of randomly without really thinking, oh, I would actually do this. Talked to a guy who's a book editor. He really liked the idea and kind of encouraged me to explore it more. And we thought this was a really good way to get the interest of people who, again, would read this and just wonder how I could do it, wonder what fermentation means. People who are not already invested in the world of fermentation, people who don't own a Sander Katz guidebook on fermentation, or aren't going to buy a guidebook explaining how to make things at home because they're not even that far into it. They just want to know what this, you know, this crazy thing is that I did. And hopefully this book allows a much broader range of people who are not necessarily, you know, already advanced home
cooks. And not a scientist yet, just a personal story. I really love how this really captures the zeitgeist around fermentation in that sort of tongue-in-cheek way, but it also offers a lot of exploration about the cultures, no pun intended, and, you know, the history throughout the world of fermentation. It's really something to geek out about if you know. It's a great compliment, I guess, to folks who are fermenting things. And certainly over the summer, when you have too much veggies, you know, you got cabbage coming out of your ears, you might want to try making kimchi or something. This is a great little companion to it. So,
yeah. And it's so easy to get started. A lot of people who, again, see it as, okay, there's, you know, this huge scientific or biology element to it, or, you know, it's advanced cooking or whatever. But it's so easy to get started to ferment, you know, a lot of vegetables that take no more time to start fermenting than making a salad. So maybe, you know, maybe some people who are just curious to find out what fermentation means will will be able to, you know, have gain the courage
I thought I knew a bit about fermentation. I've been a huge fan of Sander Alex Katz for a while, and I did not know a lot of the foods that you explored. So I really want to talk about some of these more interesting fermented foods that you explored after the break. But first, I'm just curious if you had any, like, inspirations for this book, any like interesting weird stunt diets that or mentors and maybe chefs or something doing cool stuff in fermenting, brewers.
Yeah, I mean, Sander Katz, I was actually really, really inspired by his books and and the depth and how extensively he covers the world of fermentation and going
through. He's coming up with an updated version of fermentation.
Oh, that's, I didn't actually know that. That's fantastic. Yeah, he covers so much ground in that book. I bought that, you know, years ago, and I was looking through it, and it's fascinating. I mean, you can dive into it from so many different angles. Whether I'm not a scientist,
with my background, neither is he, actually.
Right. So if you're just a I'm an English major. I mean, I'm a writer. So the creative side of it is what captivated me. So you can look at it from. The same is true with any fermented food or drink, really, in a microcosm, too. Like beer, you can approach from an engineering angle, building things, or biology, or chemistry.
You can let things spontaneously ferment, too.
Spontaneous fermentation.
There's that side of beer brewing. Maybe not best for, like, a commercial brewery, but...
Well, no, I mean, that's something that a lot of commercial breweries are getting into. I mean, we've actually done that at my brewery at Kent Falls, and it's something that the beer geeks are really latching onto is like a trendy new... not trendy, I mean, it's actually very, very old. But very exciting, very interesting, and you know, it captivates people that this process is possible and that it works and that it creates this immensely complicated complex beverages really not comparable to anything else you're ever going to find because it's gone through so many unique life cycles and stages of fermentation. There's no way to compare it to anything else because there's nothing else really like it.
Wow, that is really fascinating. Let's hear more from your book right after a quick little commercial break.
If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist.
You're listening to Superficial Rappers by Rec Tech.
All you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist.
Today's program was brought to you by Fire Cider. Did your grandmother ever tell you to drink raw apple cider vinegar? It's good advice and more common than you may think. For generations of New Englanders, a tot of vinegar was a morning ritual. Taken daily, a tablespoon of unfiltered apple cider vinegar can help support immune function and digestive functions. To the base of certified organic apple cider vinegar, Fire Cider added whole, raw, certified organic oranges, lemons, onions, ginger, horseradish, habanero pepper, garlic, and turmeric. They let this mixture steep for 6 weeks at room temperature to preserve the living vinegar culture and delicate flavors of the ingredients. Lastly, they blend a generous helping of raw wildflower honey into the mix. The result is potent but balanced, offering layers of sweet, tart, and spice. Fire Cider tastes great on its own or as an addition to tea, juice, or salad. Fire Cider ships direct from their online store and is available at over 500 locations nationwide. Use their store locator to find one near you and ask for a free sample. For more information, visit firesider.com.
All right. We're back chatting more with Derek Dellinger, whose new book is a memoir, The Fermented Man. 1 year exploring only fermented foods. Now, okay, a lot of questions come to mind immediately. Saltiness? Because a lot of things are salty. Sauerkraut?
Right, yeah.
Because you have to add salt to let it ferment.
Yeah, that was a concern, and a lot of people asked me, you know, are you worried about your blood pressure? Are you worried about the amount of salt you're eating? And I was.
Cured foods, yeah.
Right,
the
right.
The aged cheeses, they're always the saltiest.
They, yeah, you know, by necessity, fermentation generally includes a lot of salt. But, you know, what I realized, I would go to the doctor, and my blood pressure actually went down. You know, everything looked good, and I felt healthy throughout the year, despite it being kind of hard to get enough calories some days. That was the only kind of drawback of it.
Right.
In general, I felt great throughout the year. And what I realized is, you know, one, it wasn't necessarily like I was just eating pounds and pounds of salami, like the saltiest foods all the time. A lot of the stuff I was getting most of my calories from, bread and cultured butter and, you know, most cheeses are salty, but not like not just dripping with salt. You know, most of those
yogurt,
foods are
not salty.
Yogurt. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the stuff that I was getting calories from, you know, had a good amount of salt in. But in general, fermented foods, you know, they have more salt, obviously, than their raw equivalents, but not so much compared to the amount of salt we get in just the average American diet, and
right,
even in a fairly healthy diet. Where
so
you're
you couldn't eat McDonald's or anything like processed, really.
Right.
So that's cut out of your diet.
Exactly.
Completely.
Exactly. So a lot of processed foods that are also high in salt, probably more so than fermented foods, were gone from my diet. And, you know, I couldn't really eat too much at restaurants, and restaurant food tends to have a lot of salt.
So you kind of were like me. I did this thing where I didn't go to restaurants for 2 years. So you had to kind of make everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Find it fermented.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of the big trend I found was I found myself eating more simply, like eating foods in their kind of original component.
Yeah.
Separately, you know, just this maybe the same thing that you would eat in a sandwich, even non-fermented, kind of the same items, but in their fermented forms, obviously. And I would just be like, well, why should I take the time to make a sandwich? I'm just going to eat some cheese and some prosciutto and some bread and butter and pickles on the side and, you know, some kombucha. Eating things with as their own elements, eating things simply. And you, I think, have a tendency to eat less when you do that, when you're kind of sticking to the core components and not making elaborate dishes the way that you get food when you go out to a restaurant generally. And
isn't that funny? It's more simple, but actually, molecularly, it's much more complicated.
Right.
It's
right.
more complex. So.
Right.
But I think that, you know, doing what you did, like taking this, you know, crazy self-imposed diet, really, like, even just reading this, it, like, opened my eyes to a lot of other possibilities, as I'm sure it did you, about food. So, like, for example, like, you know, I guess we're looking at the pizza people are eating here, and I'm thinking, like, the sauce. Okay, it's just, you know, tomato sauce, but you could easily ferment that just a little bit, and I'm sure it would taste delicious.
Yeah. It's great, yeah. It adds, like, kind of, you know, a life to it, a zip. You know, it's hard to quantify the flavors of fermentation, but,
right. I know exactly what you mean, because, like, a chef recently prepared this dish where he had his own sort of fermented, slightly fermented salsa as a sauce, and it just made all the difference, you know? Instead of the freshness, it had this interesting kind of savoriness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it adds this kind of like intangible, lively umami character to, to things. And you can do, you know, the pizza was super easy because I could just, you know, do something as simple as throwing cherry tomatoes in a jar. All you have to do is cover them in a brine and they just ferment on their own and just slice them on top of a pizza or eat them whole. And it's requires no effort whatsoever. Like, you're literally just putting cherry tomatoes in a jar full of salt water brine and letting the lid a little loose, and that's all there is to it. So it can be like the easiest thing in the world to prepare.
So let's talk about some of these less familiar, at least to me, fermented foods that you tried. So you ate hakari, which is a rotten shark meat.
Right. So the Icelandic tradition of rotten shark meat is commonly referred to as one of the foulest smelling and most disgusting foods in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be a rite of passage for celebrity
chefs. How
was
it?
You know, I think it's... I think the celebrity chefs maybe blow it out of proportion a little bit. It's certainly a very unique experience. I have more of a texture thing, so there were probably some other things I could have found. Like the sweet...
Wait, you hated the texture?
No, the texture was okay, because it was just kind of like tough fish meat.
Oh, okay, that's all right.
But it wasn't... there was nothing really, slimy. It wasn't like slimy or like... really out of, you know, out of the range of what you think of when you're thinking like, okay, some kind of fish meat. It just smelled really, really strongly. And so it's made from the Greenland shark, and the Greenland shark.
I've never had shark. I don't think either.
This may be the only time I've actually had shark. Yeah. I really wanted to seek this out for the book. Cause it's so kind of legendary in food circles. The shark, it uses its urea as a kind of antifreeze, cause it
Great.
Can dive to really, 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 low depths in the ocean. It's just this incredible, like, prehistoric monster. Essentially, like, if you eat the shark without curing it, fermenting it properly, you will just start, like, vomiting blood because it's
Whoa.
Super poisonous.
Wow.
So the Icelanders had to find some way to live off this stuff without killing themselves.
Or the shark eating them.
Or the shark eating them, yeah. Once they got past that important point and managed to kill the shark, they had to somehow prepare the meat, so they would bury it in the ground for a couple of months, and then hang it like prosciutto chunks in a dry open side cabin to cure. So it's this long process that kind of the fermentation removes the poisonous elements from it and makes it something that's digestible and safe to eat for humans. But it still reeks of ammonia, and it kind of like burns your throat and your nostrils as you're eating it, and it just lingers. It just doesn't go away. Like you're supposed to chase it with an Icelandic like kind of national drink.
Vodka,
Brennivín,
okay.
And it's this, I actually forget, it's some kind of liqueur with herbs
in it. Did
you
do that?
I tried that separately, and it's actually pretty good, but they didn't have any when we had the shark, so we had nothing to chase it with, and it's just like secreting in our nostrils and throats. And we tried to wash it down with this like 12% ABV Imperial Stout later, like the heaviest beer you could possibly imagine.
Nope.
It just tasted like rotten shark meat, just like ammonia and
worst breath ever.
And fish, yeah.
So you must have hated this one if you're not a gooey texture person. But I actually kind of like this. It's natto,
right? I expected to really
soybeans.
Hate that, yeah, because it has like the
gooey,
slimy
mucus.
Yep. I expected to have a lot of trouble with that.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I didn't. I actually,
it's not bad, right?
I actually definitely enjoyed that too. It tastes pretty good. It's got this kind of just like sort of bitter quality that's really interesting, but
yeah,
like
true.
The umami, interesting flavor. And for some reason, I was able to transform in my mind the texture thing to like, well, it's kind of like melted cheese, like that kind of stringiness, not like slimy, mucusy, gross thing. For some reason, I was able to do that. The one that I really don't think I could ever do again was the century eggs, the
thousand year eggs,
yeah, which are fermented for a couple months, not actually 100 years or 1,000 years. You can find them in Chinatown. They look like geodes. They're kind of this green mucus looking.
I love them.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh man, I just the texture and the sight of it burned into my
my
mind.
Crazy.
But
the texture is pretty similar to regular hard boiled eggs.
It is, but it has this kind of like harder, like gummy fruit.
That's
like
true.
That doesn't quite it's one of these things, can't quite explain it, but just my mind was like, nope, not can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was the one I had a lot of trouble
century
with.
Century eggs. Wow.
Yeah.
Everyone's different. Okay.
Yeah.
What about this Sudanese dish I never heard of before your book? Shermut, Miris, and Dotori.
Yeah, they all sound really, really interesting. I have not managed to track those down.
Yeah.
I've not been to Sudan.
You comment on how, each culture, it seems, has their own crazy, way of fermenting things and preserving, the shark or what
right.
have you. So this is the Sudanese way of preserving their livestock, huge hulking animal.
Yeah,
meat,
and they use everything, the bones, the fat, and make some very interesting things out of it. And what's interesting is that, a lot of these examples, you'd expect it just to be like, well, there's not much to eat. They have to choke this stuff down to survive.
Mm-hmm.
A little choice. But, in those examples, they're considered delicacies. They're considered a lot of times condiments like, kimchi or the way we, now just put mustard and ketchup on everything.
Aged cheese.
So they're for flavor. Yeah, all these, all these fermented things are not just, eaten because we're really desperate and we need food to survive. In almost every case, there, you know, there are these kind of complex flavors that we come to really cherish and integrate into our cultures as, you know, part of our cultural identity. And they're very unique. They stand out. They're certainly, you know, distinct foods with distinct flavors, and we come to really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So going back to your, I guess, kind of recap of the whole year of eating only fermented foods, how do you think this affected your health? Because a lot of people, you know, talk about probiotics. It's good because it helps you digest the other stuff you're eating.
Right.
But you're not eating other stuff. So were you just really good at digesting?
I don't even know what that looks like, but. Right. I suppose I probably was very good at digesting. You know, it's hard to say take any scientifically credible claims.
How did you feel?
I felt great. I mean, I definitely was hungry a lot of the time. It was certainly hard to get enough calories because this was a very limited, arbitrary diet. Like I said, it's not something that, unless Oprah wants to offer me a couple $1 million or something, I'm not promoting it as this new fad diet. Yeah, no, I was very clear about that in the book and from the beginning that like this was an anecdotal experiment, not a scientific one, and something I was doing more for
history
education.
Lesson, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was for the narrative of a book and the ability to educate people on all the different ramifications.
But it is still pretty cool to know that you can do that. You can do it if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. And my editor actually did a sympathy month, as he called it. He did the same experiment for a month in October. Found a lot of the same things. You know, I actually felt really good. I mean, I had a lot of energy. I think it changed my diet in a lot of interesting ways as far as, like I said, eating simply, mm-hmm. feeling better about eating just maybe higher calorie foods than people are normally comfortable with, but I was eating them in simpler, you know, broken down small portions that it was satiated without, you know, eating this huge elaborate meal. I kind of learned a very different way of eating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And certainly obviously integrated a lot more fermented foods into my diet than before this year. Other than being hungry, no one is going to do this exact diet. So just incorporating a lot of fermented foods into your diet, I think you're going to notice a lot of positive changes. That's hopefully the goal of this, is to encourage people. You know, obviously you're not going to live off fermented food like I did, but it's very easy to incorporate a bunch of these into your diet to a much greater degree than most of us have for the last couple decades.
Yeah. Well, I love that, you know, the biggest takeaway for me reading this book was seeing food in a different way throughout it. So it's an enlightening book, I think. And I'm so glad that you shared the journey. Cool. I guess that's about all the time we have for today before we dig into a pizza. But thanks so much, Derek, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And check out The Fermented Man from Overlook Press coming out in July. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. And
thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.